Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and we are coming to you from just outside the main room at the great big giant Catholic Answers Conference on Faith and Science. We're going to do an open forum just as we do each Thursday when we're in studio, but we're doing it out of studio today. We're doing it at a remote location. The location, in case you're wondering, is the Hyatt Aventine, just outside of San Diego in La Jolla, California.
The where we are? Yeah.
At the Hyatt?
The Hyatt? You sure we're not at the Temple of Karnak? Because these giant pillars really look like the hypostyle hall at the temple at Karnak in Egypt. They're huge.
They actually do look a lot like Egyptian columns. I hadn't noticed that, Jimmy. Yeah. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist at Catholic Answers, author of many things, including The Fathers Know Best, and a new book coming out, but the most recent big book is Daily Defense, 365 Days, plus one to becoming a better apologist. Jimmy, thanks for coming down here and being with us today.
My pleasure, and it's really echoey in here, but these columns are really nice. They just don't have hieroglyphics on them.
Yeah, they should get some hieroglyphics.
That.
I mean, what
I'll
kind of place?
Paint.
How do they build a hotel and not put hieroglyphics on it? Jimmy, later we're going to be square dancing as part of the conference. I wore a blue and white check shirt, but does it look square dancing at all to you?
Or? It's fine.
It's fine. Okay, yeah. It's fine for square dancing. If you're here in the hall and you'd like to ask Jimmy Akin a question, just head over right behind us here. Marie will take your question and we'll get you up in the queue. I'm going to be tempted to give the phone number out, but I think we don't have phones available to us here, so all the questions will come from within the room. As I said, it's an open forum. But I want to ask you, Jimmy, just a very basic question as we start.
Okay.
The conference is on faith and science.
Yeah.
And some people have this idea of a conflict between faith and science. Some people say no conflict, but rarely do we define our terms. So if I take it as a given that I basically know what my faith is, what is science?
Science is a form of study or discipline that is meant to help us gain knowledge. And there are actually a bunch of different philosophies of exactly what science is. I once listened to a lecture series of like 36 lectures just on the question, what is science?
Oh my gosh. And different schools of thought will say different things.
Right. Different philosophies of science will say somewhat different things. And there's a general consensus that, okay, things like astronomy count as science, whereas things like astrology don't.
Fair enough.
One view that I'm attracted to as an explanation of what science is essentially that it's a collection of tools that have been developed over the last few hundred years for figuring out things based on observation of the natural world. And there's not a single thing that constitutes science. It's really a collection of different methods because, like, chemistry uses one set of methods, physics uses another, biology uses another. And so it's a collection of different tools, but they do have certain things in common. What's often called the scientific method involves observing the world around us and then trying to formulate an explanation for what we see. That's called a hypothesis. And then making a prediction on the basis of that hypothesis. If the hypothesis is true, then this will happen in the future.
Yes.
And then performing a test to see if that prediction holds up. And if the prediction holds up, then your hypothesis has kind of cleared its first goal. And if it clears a bunch of goals, then it gets to be called a theory. But if it fails even one prediction, then it is falsified and something is wrong somewhere. Either you got bad data or your theory is wrong.
So you said it's this collection of tools then that's been collected to do that over several hundred years.
Yeah.
How would you say, has science changed over those several hundred years? And is the change other than it just learn more? Like, was it the same thing basically several hundred years ago? Or have there been actual changes to science itself?
the method itself has developed over time, and one of the things that really came to the front in the 20th century was the idea of falsification. This was popularized by a philosopher named Karl Popper.
Yeah.
And prior to Popper's time, a lot of people said, well, what you want to do is see if you can verify your predictions, and it was all about verifying truth. But Popper pointed out, no, really the thing that's doing most of the work is if you can falsify a prediction, that shows you that something's wrong, whereas just making a true prediction doesn't necessarily prove that it's true. If I asked you to guess a random number above one, you could guess any number and it would be confirmed, but you might not guess the pattern of numbers that I'm thinking of.
Okay.
And whereas if I said guess a number above one and you couldn't guess one that fell within the pattern I'm thinking of, that would show your hypothesis was wrong. So that's one thing that's changed. Another thing that's changed is we have much better ways of measuring things now than we did hundreds of years ago. This is something that really came out in astronomy, for example. In the old days, you know, they had kind of rickety telescopes. They were made of wood or whatever, and guys would mount them on their roof at night and then sight through them looking at, say, the moons of Jupiter. And they'd write down measurements of where they thought they saw them. But there were problems because the atmosphere is in the way, and the fluctuations in the atmosphere distort what you're seeing. That's why stars twinkle.
Yes.
They don't twinkle if you're in outer space. It's the atmosphere that does that. Also, if it's a cold night, the wood base of the telescope is going to expand or contract, and that's going to put your sightings off from one night to another.
Yeah.
And for a while, there was an attempt to find, like, the perfect way, the perfect method for taking the readings of, like, where is this thing in the sky I'm looking at? And finally, they decided, actually, the most reliable things is just to average all your readings.
Oh, and so I see. Yeah, fair enough. Well, I do want to ask you before, and I want folks to know, if you're here in the room and you'd like to ask Jimmy a question, it is open forum. So any question at all is welcome.
Have to be about science.
Does not have to be about science. But I do have one more science question for you.
Okay.
Because as you demonstrated when you referred to the columns here as Egyptian, I don't even remember, you were very specific.
Well, I said it looks like the hypostyle hall in the great temple at Karnak.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, you have this pretty impressive knowledge of the ancient world, and so sometimes we, maybe in the modern world, have a tendency to go, oh, we know so much more than we're so far more advanced than they are. And in many ways, I'm sure that's true, but what did they get right in the ancient world, ancient science?
Well, one thing that they famously got right is the fact that the Earth is a sphere. That's something that we often hear actually denied in popular culture, that they thought the Earth was flat.
Right.
But by the time of the ancient Greeks, the pre-Socratic philosophers, they already knew it was a sphere. And they talk about how it's day because the sun is shining on our hemisphere right now. But when it's not shining on our hemisphere, it's dark. They also even figured out the size of the Earth. There was a philosopher several hundred years before the time of Christ named Eratosthenes, and he was living in Alexandria, Egypt, and he heard about a town farther south where on the equinox the sun shone at midday, the sun shone straight down a well, leaving no shadow. But he was in Alexandria further north, and he knew that at that same time of day on the equinox the sun did cast a shadow. And so what he did was he hired a guy to walk off the distance between Alexandria and that town, and he was then able to calculate how far along the curve of the Earth that town must be from where he was based on the length of the shadow, and that told him how wide the Earth is. And he was very close to modern estimates. He really got it within of just a few percentage points of being right.
You are listening to Catholic Answers Live. We are located today outside the big room at the great big giant Catholic Answers Conference on Faith and Science. 2 hours of open forum today for the program, but we'll take our questions from right here in the room with us. If you've got a question, head over to Marie. She will let you get your question submitted, and we'll try to get to it this hour or next hour. We've got 2 hours of this open forum. I want to let you know that Jimmy's book, The Fathers Know Best, is being sold here at the conference for $10. And so we thought, what the heck? If we can sell the book for $10 at the conference, while the conference is going on, why not sell it to you at $10? So for our listeners who won't be joining us at this year's conference, we're offering that special Jimmy pricing on The Fathers Know Best all weekend long. Go to shop.catholic.com and pick up your copy today for just $10.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
It's the start of a new day for Morning Catholic Radio.
Isn't it the case that when you're stirring food in a pot, it burns less, like, because it's not just sitting there?
What about your forearms? You get some nice buff forearms when you're doing that stirring.
But let me say, I can totally
get this for you, Gloria. You don't need any help stirring the pot.
You know, you all make it so easy for me.
Morning Glory, Catholic from the start. Weekday mornings, 7 Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live Open Forum. 2 hours of Open Forum today. First hour, Jimmy Akin here with us. Jimmy, as you know, is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of many things, including A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and the new book coming out in we could probably measure it in hours now. But
we could
be maybe a few hundred hours.
We could measure the time since the beginning of the universe in hours if we wanted. It'd just be a big number.
Yeah, it would be a big number. Okay, so the book comes out...
Late October is the plan.
And that one is...
Teaching with Authority.
Teaching with Authority. I'm so scared to say it now.
Dogma, doctrine, and the teaching of the magisterium.
All right, lots of folks lined up to ask you questions. Jimmy, are you ready to take some questions?
Absolutely.
All right, we start with, I believe, Andrew from Dover, Pennsylvania. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Thanks for coming. Your question for Jimmy.
This came from my 7-year-old granddaughter. She asked me, if Adam and Eve were our first parents, why don't we all have the same last name?
The answer is because last names have not existed for all of human history. They're actually comparatively recent, and not all cultures use them even today. This is why in some cultures, like if you read in the New Testament, you'll find that the Hebrews did not have last names. Nobody in the Bible has a last name. The Hebrews all had what are called patronyms, from the word pater, meaning father. And so they're typically called after their father. That's why Simon Peter is known as Simon the son of John. And that was a typical way of referring to someone back then. In Hebrew, the word for son is Ben. And in Aramaic, it's Bar. And so that's why you see names like Bartolomai, Bartholomew, the son of Ptolemy, or Ben-Gurion, David Ben-Gurion, David the son of Gurion. And this is not just an ancient custom. It's used in various places around the world today. In Russia, for example, lots of people are known by patronyms. Someone might be known as Ivan Ivanovich, meaning Ivan the son of Ivan. Or in Iceland, you'll meet people named, you know, Jan Eriksson, John the son of Eric. Or trying to think of a female name, Gerta Eriksdottir, Gerta the daughter of Eric. And so patronyms like that, being named after your father, are a common way that people have identified each other by family down through history. There are other ways too, but what we think of as a last name is comparatively recent and doesn't exist in all languages. In fact, even in English, you can kind of tell how recent some of them are because you'll have people who have names like Baker. That's an occupation. Somebody in this guy's family way back was a baker, and that's why they got that name. Or Cartwright, someone who fixes carts. And so we can see how even in English, a lot of names are of, a lot of last names are of recent origin. So that's why.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Andrew. We're struggling a little bit with the microphones here, but it's all good. Thanks very much for the question, Andrew, from Dover, Pennsylvania. It would be funny if Adam was like, "Hello, Eve. I'm Adam. I didn't catch your last name, Adam. I'm the only other person on Earth.
You know the classic line at that point, Madam, I'm Adam.
Oh no,
which is a palindrome. So you
can
It goes both ways. It spells Madam, I'm Adam the same forwards and backwards.
Ah, very good. Up next is Chanda. Chanda came by the studio yesterday. She is from, as if I recall correctly, Zambia by way of Maryland. Is that correct?
Yep.
All right, Chanda, you're going to need to get right up next to that microphone. Go ahead, your question for Jimmy. She can pull it down. You can pull it down.
Okay. So I was just wondering if you could shed some light on the idea that Christmas was hijacked from a pagan holiday. Mm-hmm. And if that's not the case, if 25th December was likely around the time that Jesus was born, and if not, when would have been the time that he would have been born, approximately?
Well, you commonly hear the claim that Christmas is ripped off from a pagan holiday, but there are some problems with that. One holiday, the first question to ask is, like, what holiday are we talking about? We know what the pagan holidays were. And sometimes you'll have people saying it was a holiday called Saturnalia. Saturnalia was a feast that they had in Rome of the god Saturn, and it was kind of like April Fool's Day, only it went on for a while. People would do crazy stuff to unwind, kind of joking stuff. And the trouble is, Saturnalia originally was like December 17th, and they later extended it to December 23rd or so, but it was never December 25th. And so that doesn't make any sense to claim that Christmas was ripped off of Saturnalia. There's another holiday, though, that at one time was celebrated on December 25th, and that's a holiday called the birth of Sol Invictus, the unconquerable sun. And the reason it was celebrated on December 25th is that was often regarded as the date of the winter equinox, when the sun, when the days begin to grow longer again. And so that made it a symbol of when the unconquerable sun is reborn every year. And we do know that at least in some periods, Sol Invictus was celebrated on December 25th. The problem is the earliest record we have of that is after the earliest record we have of Christmas being celebrated on December 25th. So we already see Christians celebrating Christmas on December 25th before we get a documentation of Sol Invictus happening on that day. So that's kind of a shaky thing as well. The thing for me that cinches the fact that this is not what's going on, that Christmas was not simply borrowed from a pagan holiday, is two things. One of them is that we never find Christians saying, hey, let's go hijack a pagan holiday. You know, let's provide people an alternative celebration. We do find people doing that today sometimes. I originally, you know, was evangelical, and there are people in the evangelical community who don't like Halloween because of all the, you know, creepy imagery that's become associated with it in popular culture. And so some of them would have Harvest Festival instead of Halloween, or they'd have Reformation Day Festival instead of Halloween. And they were consciously setting out to provide an alternative, what they thought was wholesomer celebration to this holiday they didn't like. And they were explicit about that fact. They'd say, that's what we need to do for the sake of our kids. We don't want them getting wrapped up in Halloween, so we're going to have this alternative celebration. And we don't see the early Christians saying that. And they should have said that if that's what they were up to. Also, I frankly find it hard to believe that early Christian bishops who were really not fond of paganism at all, I find it really hard to believe that they would want to have anything to do with a pagan holiday, even replacing it. So we just don't have good evidence that Christmas was based on a pagan holiday. Instead, what we find if we read the Church Fathers is that the ones who identify December 25th as Jesus' birthday really think that that's when he was born. They just say it straight out, this is when he was born. But that's not the only opinion in the early church. There are also other early Christian writers who will propose other dates, like January 6th, which is now the Feast of the Epiphany. And there are a few others around in different times of the year. Most of them seem to center in the winter time, but there are other dates proposed. And so ultimately, it's a matter of speculation exactly when Jesus was born. It could have been December 25th. It could have been another day. The important thing for us is that he was born. And of course, the church, so for the sake of us having a common liturgical life, has decided we'll use December 25th. But it's not a teaching of the faith that he had to be born that day.
Okay, Chanda?
Yep, thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the question. It's open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. 2 hours of open forum. Second hour, Tim Staples will be here. This hour, we've got Jimmy Akin with us. And open forum means any question at all about the Catholic faith, about Catholic history, maybe about Catholic moral teaching, whatever you got on your mind. Next up is Carol from Vail, Arizona. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Hi, Carol. Right up on the microphone.
Is that good?
That's good.
Okay. Thank you for taking my question. It's such a joy to be here and to meet you all. So my question has to do with... Are you listening? My question has to do with a fertility-saving treatment. And I was a nurse for 32 years in labor and delivery and never heard of this one, so I was wondering if it was ethical. When a woman is going to have chemo and radiation therapy, a lot of times it kills the functioning of the ovaries. So what they do in this procedure, they preemptively remove one of the ovaries and they freeze it. And then after their treatment's done and the woman wants to get pregnant, they take the cortex of the ovary that was removed and they put it on the non-functioning ovary. And many times that just fires it up on its own. And then the couple can conceive naturally. And I'm not sure, but they may sometimes need to use some hormone therapy, but I'm not positive about that. Mm-hmm.
And you'd like to know, is that morally permissible?
Yes.
Well, based on my understanding of what you've just said, and I've had a little trouble hearing because of the noise in the hall, but based on my understanding of what you've just said, I don't see an ethical issue here. It's not unethical to extract an ovary and then reimplant it later. There's nothing wrong intrinsically with that. And if that helps also rejuvenate the other ovary, that's fine. The use of hormones to supplement, one's fertility is fine, whether you're a man or a woman. What is not permissible is replacing the way that God has designed for human sexuality to work, but this doesn't sound like replacing it. It would be replacing it if, let's say, you said, okay, we're going to take out an ovary, and then we're going to harvest ova from it, and we're going to unite them with male germ cells in a petri dish. Well, okay, now we're not talking about assisting the process of reproduction that God designed into our nature. Then we'd be talking about replacing it by creating babies in glass jars, and that's a different thing. It sounds like what you're describing is directing the medical procedures so that the woman has revived fertility after the chemotherapy and is therefore able to use the normal reproductive process that God built into us.
Thank you.
No problem.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Carol. Appreciate that question. To everybody who's here in the room, if you've got a question, if you just come over to Marie, she'll get you up on the microphone. As a matter of fact, we'd love to have your questions.
In fact, we need to have your questions.
The show gets really dull if we don't have questions. So we're happy to have you. We are here at just outside the great big ballroom, which they're getting ready for a couple of big talks tonight. Dr. Stacy Drasenkos, as listeners of the show know, Dr. Stacy Drasenkos, a scientist and theologian. She will be giving our first talk tonight. Carlo Broussard giving our second talk tonight. Then Jimmy will be leading us in some square dancing. So lots and lots happening here at the conference. And we're basically going over the course of the next several days to try to, from various different angles, approach the question of faith and science. Jimmy, would you agree with me? It's one of the most pressing questions of our time.
What?
The question of faith and science. It's one of the most pressing questions of our time.
Well, maybe, but what is it?
Oh, I see. What you mean in particular, which question?
Yeah, what is the question of faith and science?
Okay, if I posed it to you this way, if I said the intellectual challenges to faith that are being posed by people in the name of science are very serious challenges. Would you agree with
sure.
that?
Yeah, okay.
Oh, lost my mic there for a second. I'm so glad I found a way to phrase that for you.
It's like question of life, the universe, and everything. We know the answer is 42, but what exactly is the question?
That's the thing is, you're going to have to ask Zaphod Beeblebrox, and then he can help you on that.
He wasn't too sure.
Open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. Folks lining up to ask questions. If you have questions that you would like to ask Jimmy Akin, come on over here to Marie, and she will get you in the queue to ask those questions. The conference is on faith and science, but it's an open forum today. So any question you've got on the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church is welcome. And don't forget, Jimmy Akin's book is on sale at shop.catholic.com.
This is Harry Connick Jr., and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Is the Church wrong on contraception? In a culture that worships the pursuit of sexual pleasure, the Catholic Church's teaching on contraception can seem archaic and unintelligible. Its critics say it's outdated, theologically unfounded, and even harmful. And even faithful Catholics can have difficulty explaining this moral teaching. Catholic Answers is out to change all of that. That's why we've just released Trent Horn's dynamic new DVD, The Case Against Contraception. Using scripture, papal and magisterial teachings, natural law, and new insights provided by social science and medicine, Trent puts forward a compelling case for Catholic teachings with his trademark charity and persuasive graciousness. Be prepared to give a defense. Order your copy of The Case Against Contraception today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
With the recent commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the release of Humani Vitae, there have been fresh attacks on Catholic teaching from outside and, unfortunately, inside the Church. That's why Catholic Answers thought it critical to provide a vigorous affirmation of Pope Paul VI's prophetic wisdom with our newest book, Inseparable, Five Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humani Vitae. We asked five distinguished contributors to reflect on and defend Humani Vitae from five perspectives, each of them compelling, together forming a mosaic of truth. Don't be caught uninformed when the topic comes up among friends, family, and coworkers. Order your copy of Inseparable today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or by visiting the shop at Catholic.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Thursday's always open forum. We're almost always open for him. Tim Staples will be here, second hour, Jimmy Akin. It's pretty hard to beat a Jimmy Akin hour followed by a Tim Staples hour. And we have that great privilege, partly because they're here at the conference. So we asked them if they'd do the show with us. They graciously said yes. Jimmy, of course, is the senior apologist at Catholic Answers. Been doing this apologetic stuff professionally for more than 25 years. He'll correct me if I'm wrong. I'm pretty sure I'm right about that. More than 25 years as an apologist. And we're taking all of our questions from in the room today. Well, when I say room, we're in the hall where registration is going on and people are gathering and we're getting ready for the big talks tonight from Dr. Trisankos and from Carlo Broussard. Next up with a question for Jimmy is Marilyn from Colorado Springs. Am I correct about that?
Yes.
Hi, Marilyn.
How do you do?
Very well, thanks. Your question for Jimmy.
My question is, by what criteria were books like the Didache and the Letter of Clement to the Corinthians excluded from the canon of the New Testament?
Ultimately, it's the guidance of the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit guided the Church to not include those two particular books in the canon of the New Testament. However, it gets fuzzier on the human level, because on the human level, the church initially in the first few centuries had a kind of fuzzy canon. It didn't have the kind of strict canonical boundaries that it does, or stricter canonical boundaries that it does today. So, for example, you mentioned the first letter of Clement, and some people actually did consider that to be part of the New Testament for a time. It wasn't ultimately included, but some early people did, and some people may well have done the same thing for the Didache as well. When the canon was finalized, the criteria that were principally used were twofold. One, did it have a clear connection to the apostles, such that it was written by an apostle or one of the associates of the apostles? And two, did it teach the doctrine that had been handed down in the church by tradition from the apostles and their associates? Well, on these scores, both Clement and the Didache fare pretty well. They're both orthodox documents. Neither one of them contains heresy. The Didache appears to be a first century document. Some people have even dated it as early as the AD 30s. And for people who may not know what the Didache is, it's basically a first century church manual that has instruction on basic morality and how to become a Christian and how to celebrate the sacraments and things like that. And it appears to date from the first century, let's say the mid-first century. So even if it wasn't written by an apostle, it was written at a time when the apostles were around and thus could be viewed as written by some of their associates. Clement of Rome is even more clearly, the author of First Clement, is even more clearly an associate of apostles. In fact, we have early traditions recording that he was ordained by the apostles and that he's the Clement who's mentioned in St. Paul's letters. So he could have been considered an associate of an apostle and thus an appropriate author for the New Testament, for a New Testament book, the same way that Mark or Luke were associates of the Apostle Paul and Peter and could be appropriate New Testament authors. But at some point, there comes a kind of choice that has to be made. Like, how close are these guys to the apostles? How valuable is this information compared to what we see in the New Testament books? And we can't really give a hard and fast reason why the Holy Spirit guided the early church the way he did. So we ultimately kind of have to go back to, it was the Spirit's decision to guide people to recognize these books but not these others.
Is that a satisfactory answer?
That works for me.
Okay, thank you very much. Just real quick, Jimmy, I want to ask you about the Didache. She mentioned the Didache. That's actually a very early writing of the church that got lost for a good long time.
It was lost until the 1800s when it was rediscovered, yes. We knew little bits about it, but then we found the actual item.
Were there any surprises, like things that the Didache, I guess it's kind of a manual, a church manual.
Yeah, it's not huge surprises, but it does do some very interesting things. For example, it documents that there was more than one mode of baptism in the first century. It says that if you can, baptize in running water, which it calls living water.
Yep.
And if you can't, then it says baptize in standing water that's cold. And if you can't do that, baptize in standing water that's warm. And if you can't do that, pour water on the head three times.
So anything to get the job done, basically, as long as you got water.
Yeah, but one of the things that does is it sheds light on what was the practice of the first century church, because a lot of people in, say, the evangelical community have the idea that there's only one correct mode of baptism, like it's got to be immersion or something like that. Well, not according to first century Christians. It didn't got to be immersion. It could be other things like pouring or effusion.
Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour. It is our usual open forum for Thursday afternoons, but this time open forum is on location at the Great Big Giant Faith and Science Conference, Catholic Answers Conference, here in La Jolla, California. Lots and lots of folks here. If you are out there in the audience and you have a question, I just especially because people are just registering and showing up. I got to keep reminding folks of this. Marie, over here in the corner, will take your question and get you all set up to be able to talk with Jimmy. Up next is Susie from Oregon. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you for coming to the conference, Susie. Your question for Jimmy.
My question is, why is it that the church has never declared a saint that's outside of the church that's not Catholic, and is that likely to change?
It's not likely to change in the foreseeable future. The basic reason is because if you're outside of the church, why is that? You know, the saints are meant to be held up as models of holiness and orthodoxy, who are faithful Christians living a life of heroic virtue. And if you're not inside the church, there's some reason for that. It could be heresy, that you had some theological views that shouldn't be held up for the imitation of the faithful. It could be schism, that you just didn't take seriously the obligation to fully integrate into Christ's church. And so for those reasons, the church has not ordinarily canonized anyone who was not an active member of its own communion during their life. But there is a kind of exception. The exception occurs when a non-Catholic church that has its own saints is reunited with the Catholic Church. Like, for example, the Chaldean Catholic Church. At one time, they weren't in communion with the Catholic Church, but if they made saints during that period from their own communion, then those saints tend to be recognized once full communion with the Catholic Church was restored. And so there is kind of an exception for people who became part of the saints of their community prior to its reconciliation with Rome, and there is a bit of an exception for that. But in terms of someone who was just never a Catholic, not part of a community that's come back into communion, the church doesn't want to be holding those people up as examples of sainthood because of the questions that would be about, well, does it really matter if you're Catholic or not? Or what about these views? What about schism? Aren't those important? What has been floated as an idea in recent years is not sainthood, but this is something John Paul II mentioned as a possibility, some kind of common martyrology where we recognize martyrs from each community as having given their lives for Christ, even if they're not fully canonized and we're not saying for sure they're in heaven, we could still have some kind of ecumenical acknowledgement of these people's attempt to, you know, serve Christ by the giving of their lives.
Susie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, we'll probably take a quick break, but I wanted to remind folks that are listening that September is about to end. In case you hadn't noticed, we're coming up to the very end of the month this weekend. And we've been telling you for several weeks that you can get a Advent Christmas subscription delivered to whoever you'd like to give that to as a gift. Only if you subscribe for them before the end of September. That way they can get on all the proper lists and we can get those magazines printed out and sent out to them. Catholic Answers Magazine, one of the finest Catholic magazines you will come across anywhere. Jimmy, you have an article in the...
I do, and it's on the dating of Christmas, and it goes into the same kind of stuff I talked about earlier in the broadcast today, but in a lot more detail.
Oh, great. And that will be in the Advent Christmas issue.
Yeah, it'll be in the November-December issue.
So you just go to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com, CatholicAnswersMagazine.com. You get your subscription for $19.95. That's a gift subscription for $19.95. It's a great deal. I recommend it to all of you in this room as well. It's a very fine magazine. And what comes with that? A free digital subscription as well. So it's just all around a great deal. You got to get it before the end of September, however. Go to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
You know what Catholic radio is? It's training for the troops. It's a interaural of the ear boot camp. The folks who listen, who grow in their faith, grow in charity, grow in all the virtues, they then go out and exert an influence far beyond just themselves. Catholic radio has an exponential effect. for bringing people deeper into the faith.
Dr. Ray Guarendi thinks Catholic radio is important. So should you.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
We're not taking live calls. However, we invite you to stay with us and enjoy the broadcast. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live Open Forum. I am Cy Killett, your host, Jimmy Akin, still with us because we are still in the midst of our first hour of Open Forum today. That means lots and lots of questions still to come today. Second hour, Tim Staples will be here with us. Don't forget, tomorrow we'll be our special guests on the program will be Dr. Stacy Trusenkos and Father Terrence Ehrman, who are both speakers here at the Catholic Answers Conference on Faith and Science. It'll be 2 hours of questions on faith and science, and pretty much any question you've got on faith and science or faith and science together will be welcome then. So please join us tomorrow for that wonderful show. Today, open forum, just like we always do open forum. Any question is welcome on the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church. We just have to convince the people in the room to come up to the microphone and ask a question. And I see some people weakening, like, okay, maybe I'll go up to the microphone. So weaken fully, come on up and ask your question. Up next.
Give in to temptation.
Yes, give in to this temptation. Don't hold back. Tim from St. George, Utah. Your question for Jimmy Akin. Tim.
Hi, I have a friend who is a former Mormon. She found out about the teachings of the faith, who's broken away from the church. Needless to say, her world has been turned upside down. Her faith has been shattered. She's questioning God, and I'm wondering how I can help her back on this spiritual journey.
Well, I would say, and it's going to require some prudential judgment on your part, because you know her and I don't. But one of the things I would say is this would be a good time to give her some Christian apologetics. One of the things about Mormonism is it's very much based on feelings. They don't offer concrete evidence for their faith. They don't have the concept of a single all-powerful creator, and so they don't offer the kinds of philosophical proofs that we would for the existence of such a God. They also, because archaeology does not support the Book of Mormon, they really try to stay away from providing evidence from the ancient world to try to prove various points in support of their scriptures. But archaeology is on the side of our scriptures. And so I would say you might want to check out a book like The Handbook of Catholic Apologetics by Peter Kraft and Ronald Ticelli. It covers all kinds of different things. It covers the existence of God. It covers why I believe in Jesus. It covers the reliability of the New Testament. And that kind of information could be of great help to her. Also, just thinking through from a psychological point of view, Mormonism portrays itself as a kind of Christianity. And unfortunately, it's actually not. But it portrays itself as a kind of Christianity. And so she has for a long time thought of herself as a Christian. And it should be of comfort to her to realize, I can still be a Christian. I just don't have to be a Mormon anymore, but I can still be a Christian and I can come closer to Christ in this way. And here are actual evidences that are being offered for me for the Christian faith, whereas Mormonism didn't provide those. So this will allow me to be even more confident in my faith now that it's not simply based on feelings. So that book that I mentioned, The Handbook of Catholic Apologetics, that would be a good one. Why We're Catholic by Trent Horn, Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, or Miracles by C.S. Lewis, my book, A Daily Defense, any of those could be helpful. So I would say take a look at some of those books, see what you think would be of most help to her, and then share that with her. Also, you might let her know about Catholic Answers. She might find benefit in listening to the radio show or going to our website, catholic.com.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the question, Tim. Open forum today, Jimmy Akin, our guest. Some questions folks are going to come to the microphone for. Some are just written out for us, and I want to ask one that I've been kind of, I haven't gotten to yet, Jimmy, but and I don't have the name of the person who submitted the question, but someone here in
someone
this room
asked it.
Yeah, asked, when did the Magi actually come to see Jesus?
I could give a flip answer with a really highly specific time, but I'm not going to do that now, this time. Instead, I'll give you an honest answer, which is a general one. We don't know exactly, but it was between about 1 and 2 years after Jesus was born. This is one of the things that we're often misled by with Christmas cards and Christmas artwork, where you see a nativity scene depicted and it's got the Magi right there. No, they were not there on the night Jesus was born. The shepherds were, Luke tells us that. But the Magi didn't show up for a long time. They saw his star rise in the east, or some would translate it as at its helical rising, which is a special astronomy thing. And then they had to undertake a big journey from their homeland. So they did not arrive immediately at all. The reason I say that it was a year or two later is because when they leave, Herod has the baby boys in Bethlehem put to death if they're 2 years old or younger, in accord with the time he learned from the Magi of when the star appeared. So he's assuming when he was born, that's when the star appeared. That was at least a year ago, but he may have padded it by another year just to be sure. So somewhere between 1 and 2 years afterwards. And that's even confirmed in Matthew that they're not in the stable or the cave at the time. They're in a house at this point, because it says in Matthew when the Magi show up, they go into the house and see the child with his mother.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I never thought about that. Yeah, so they're in a house. Well, thank you, Jimmy. A Magi, by the way, it's the root word of magic?
Yeah, the root word in Latin is well, in Latin, it's magus.
Magus. Okay.
Magoi is the plural in Greek. It's ultimately derived from a kind of priestly class of people in Persia. But the term came to be used more broadly for people who had knowledge of spiritual and magical and things like that, and including how to read signs like a star appearing and what it might mean and things like that.
Fair enough. Next up is Maria from Santa Ana, California. Maria, thanks for coming. Thanks for your question. What is it?
Okay, my question is regarding the books of the Bible. With a lot of people, specifically our Protestant brothers and sisters, we talk about when we're reading the Bible, each book is different, and we're to understand it according to who wrote it, when, why. And so where's a good place to start in gathering that knowledge of how to understand each book of the Bible? And I'm sure that Scott Hahn has work. Jimmy, I'm sure you have work. Mm-hmm. But also, more specifically, does the Catholic Church formally say somewhere, these are the books, well, not these are the books, they do that, but this is who wrote them, why, how we're to understand them?
The Catholic Church doesn't do what you just asked about. At one point, there was a kind of endorsement of the traditional authors of the various books of the Bible that had been proposed, but the church has really backed off of that. In the course of the 20th century, it discerned that the important thing is not actually who specifically wrote it or when specifically it was written. The important thing is that it is the inspired word of God, and that's why it's authoritative for us. So if you thought maybe St. Paul didn't write all of the epistles that are commonly attributed to him, like Hebrews. During much of church history, not all of it, but much of church history, it was commonly regarded that Paul was the author of Hebrews. Early on, though, there was a lot of doubt about it. And other authors, including Clement of Alexandria and Barnabas, were proposed as the author of Hebrews. But Hebrews does not say. Luke has also been proposed as a potential author of Hebrews, as has Apollos. Well, all of these guys were within Paul's circle, and so it's not surprising that Hebrews sounds a little bit like Paul, but it also sounds a little bit not like Paul. And so more recently, the church has said it doesn't really matter which one of these guys wrote it, whether it was Paul or Clement or Barnabas or whoever. This was recognized by the church under the guidance of the Holy Spirit as divinely inspired scripture, and so it is, and it's authoritative. So the church leaves it to the discussion of scholars to figure out, well, is the traditional author the right one, or maybe it was somebody else? That's a matter that's left up to scholars. The church also doesn't propose hard and fast guidelines on here is exactly how you should interpret these books. There are individual passages where the church has said this verse must mean at least this. It may have other meanings too, but it must mean at least this. And there are a few passages like that, about half a dozen to a dozen of them. But for the most part, the meaning of Scripture is something that the church lets scholars work out as long as they don't contradict a doctrine of the faith. In terms of where concretely to go, if you're just wanting to make a basic start on learning about the individual books of the Bible, one thing that would be good to check out is what's called an introduction. Introductions are works that are written specifically to tell you a little bit about each book, either of the New Testament or of the Old Testament or both, and they'll tell you about the common theories about the book. They'll summarize its contents, and they typically go into questions of who wrote it and when and why and so forth. I know Ignatius Press has just come out with an introduction to the Old Testament that you might want to check out. There are a variety of introductions to the New Testament, many of them by evangelicals, and they're fine in many cases. There was another introduction to the Old Testament that was put out a number of years ago by Ignatius Press in the 90s, and I've got its cover, which is red in my mind, but I'm afraid I can't remember the title. But you might want to check out their website and see what other introductions they have available.
You're looking for a red book from the 90s, okay?
By Ignatius.
Wait, do you have any follow-up? Or does that satisfy your question, or did you have a follow-up?
Well, I guess then the question about how we're supposed to understand all the books of the Bible is still up there. Okay. But are you saying that we have to keep them in line with the doctrines and the dogmas of the Catholic Church?
Basically, yeah. We're to understand them within that context. In the early church, that was called the rule of faith. The faith has been handed on to us from the apostles, and so we need to understand the scriptures in accord with that rule of faith. There are more specific techniques that are used. They're called, the fancy word for them is hermeneutic. A hermeneutic is a principle of interpretation. And so there are various hermeneutics that you want to apply in reading the scriptures. You want to read carefully. You want to understand what words meant in their original context. How would the original audience have understood this text? Things like that. And there are also a lot of books on hermeneutics that you might want to check out. A lot of them are written kind of for academics. There's a famous one called The Hermeneutical Spiral that a lot of people have found useful, but that's more on an academic level. You may find that an introduction kind of helps give you the basic foundation, then you can go deeper as you need.
Okay. And one other question regarding the dogmas of the church, where do we officially find those? I found them on various websites, but not necessarily the
Okay.
Vatican.
What a great question.
Yeah, so I should clarify what a dogma is real quick. A dogma is something that the church has infallibly taught to be divinely revealed. There are other things the church has infallibly taught that it hasn't said are divinely revealed, and then there are things it just is taught but not infallibly. There's not a single source for those. They're found, obviously, in the church's documents. There's not an official list of them at this point. The best advice I can give is check out my upcoming book, Teaching with Authority, which goes into all this, including the specific sources to look at to find the documents, and then the various tests, the hermeneutics, that you want to apply to them in understanding them.
So the church has documents?
It has actual documents you can look at and read.
You're definitely going to need Jimmy Akin's brand new book, available in bookstores everywhere at the end of October. Jimmy Akin, thanks for a great hour.
My pleasure, Cyril.
Yeah, Keller. Big hand for Jimmy Akin. We're not done, however. Hang around. We have a full hour more of open forum. Tim Staples will be joining us. All the questions will be coming from folks in the room here, or in the hallway here, outside the main room, at the big, giant Catholic Answers Conference on Faith and Science. More of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.